Funny, isn't it? The tricks fate plays. He was silent for a minute or two. The sun had set, and the velvety darkness of the African night was enveloping us like a mantle. "Some of it I know," I said gently.
"What do you know?"
"I know that your real name is Harry Lucas." Still, he hesitated, not looking at me, but staring straight out in front of him. I had no clue as to what was passing in his mind, but at last he jerked his head forward as though acquiescing in some unspoken decision of his own, and began his story. Chapter 26.
"You are right. My real name is Harry Lucas. My father was a retired soldier who came out to farm in Rhodesia. He died when I was in my second year at Cambridge."
"Were you fond of him?" I asked suddenly.
I don't know." Then he flushed and went on with sudden vehemence. "Why do I say that? I did love my father. We said bitter things to each other for the last time I saw him, and we had many rows over my wildness and my debts. But I cared for the old man. I know how much now, when it's too late," he continued more quietly. "It was at Cambridge that I met the other fellow."
"Young Eardsley?"
"Yes, young Eardsley. His father, as you know, was one of South Africa's most prominent men. We drifted together at once, my friend and I. We had our love of South Africa in common, and we both had a taste for the untrodden places of the world.
After he left Cambridge, Eardsley had a final quarrel with his father.
The old man had paid his debts twice. He refused to do so again. There was a bitter scene between them. Sir Lawrence declared himself at the end of his patience. He would do no more for his son. He must stand on his own legs for a while. The result was, as you know, that those two young men went off to South America together, prospecting for diamonds. I'm not going into that now, but we had a wonderful time out there. Hardships in plenty, you understand. But it was a good life, a hand-to-mouth scramble for existence far from the beaten track. And my God, that's the place to know a friend. There was a bond forged between us two there that only death could have broken. Well, as Colonel Race told you, our efforts were crowned with success. We found a second Kimberley in the heart of the British Guiana jungles. I can't tell you our elation. It wasn't so much the actual value in money of the find. You see, Eardsley was used to money, and he knew that when his father died, he would be a millionaire. And Lucas had always been poor and was used to it. No, it was the sheer delight of discovery."
He paused and then added almost apologetically,
"You don't mind my telling it this way, do you? As though I wasn't in it at all. It seems like that now, when I look back and see those two boys. I almost forget that one of them was Harry Raeburn."
"Tell it any way you like," I said, and he went on.
"We came to Kimberley, very cock-a-hoop over our find. We brought a magnificent selection of diamonds with us to submit to the experts, and then, in the hotel at Kimberley, we met her."
I stiffened a little, and the hand that rested on the doorpost clenched itself involuntarily.
"Anita Grunberg, that was her name. She was an actress, quite young and very beautiful. She was South African-born, but her mother was a Hungarian, I believe. There was some sort of mystery about her, and that, of course, heightened her attraction for two boys home from the wilds. She must have had an easy task. We both fell for her right away, and we both took it hard. It was the first shadow that had ever come between us. But even then, it didn't weaken our friendship. Each of us, I honestly believe, was willing to stand aside for the other to go in and win. But that wasn't her game. Sometimes, afterwards, I wondered why it hadn't been, for Sir Lawrence Eardsley's only son was quite a parti. But the truth of it was that she was married to a sorter in De Beers, though nobody knew of it. She pretended enormous interest in our discovery, and we told her all about it and even showed her the diamonds. Delilah, that's what she should have been called. and she played her part well. The De Beers robbery was discovered, and like a thunderclap, the police came down upon us. They seized our diamonds. We only laughed at first. The whole thing was so absurd. And then the diamonds were produced in court, and without question they were the stones stolen from De Beers. Anita Grunberg had disappeared. She had effected the substitution neatly enough, and our story that these were not the stones originally in our possession was laughed to scorn. Sir Lawrence Eardsley had enormous influence. He succeeded in getting the case dismissed, but it left two young men ruined and disgraced to face the world with the stigma of thief attached to their name, and it pretty well broke the old fellow's heart. He had one bitter interview with his son in which he heaped upon him every reproach imaginable. He'd done what he could to save the family name, but from that day on his son was his son no longer. He cast him off utterly, and the boy, like the proud young fool that he was, remained silent, disdaining to protest his innocence in the face of his father's disbelief. He came out furious from the interview. His friend was waiting for him. A week later, war was declared. The two friends enlisted together. You know what happened. The best pal a man ever had was killed, partly through his own mad recklessness in rushing into unnecessary danger. He died with his name tarnished. I swear to you, Anne, that it was mainly on his account that I was so bitter against that woman. It had gone deeper with him than with me. I had been madly in love with her for a moment. I even think that I frightened her sometimes. But with him, it was a quieter and deeper feeling. She had been the very centre of his universe, and her betrayal of him tore up the very roots of life. The blow stunned him and left him paralysed.
Harry paused. After a minute or two, he went on.
As you know, I was reported missing, presumed killed. I never troubled to correct the mistake. I took the name of Parker and came to this island, which I knew of old. At the beginning of the war, I had had ambitious hopes of proving my innocence, but now all that spirit seemed dead. All I felt was, what's the good? My power was dead. Neither he nor I had any living relations who would care. I was supposed to be dead too. Let it remain at that. I led a peaceful existence here, neither happy nor unhappy, numbed of all feeling. I see now, though I did not realize it at the time, that that was partly the effect of the war. And then one day, something occurred to wake me right up again. I was taking a party of people in my boat on a trip up the river, and I was standing at the landing stage helping them in, when one of the men uttered a startled exclamation. It focused my attention on him. He was a small, thin man with a beard, and he was staring at me for all he was worth as though I was a ghost. So powerful was his emotion that it awakened my curiosity. I made inquiries about him at the hotel and learned that his name was Carton, that he came from Kimberley, and that he was a diamond sorter employed by De Beers. In a minute, all the old sense of wrong surged over me again. I left the island and went to Kimberley. I could find out little more about him, however. In the end, I decided that I must force an interview. I took my revolver with me. In the brief glimpse I had had of him, I had realized that he was a physical coward. No sooner were we face to face than I recognized that he was afraid of me. I soon forced him to tell me all he knew. He had engineered part of the robbery, and Anita Grunberg was his wife. He had once caught sight of both of us when we were dining with her at the hotel, and having read that I was killed, my appearance in the flesh at the falls had startled him badly. He and Anita had married quite young, but she had soon drifted away from him. She had got in with a bad lot, he told me, and it was then for the first time that I heard of the Colonel. Carton himself had never been mixed up in anything except this one affair. So he solemnly assured me, and I was inclined to believe him. He was emphatically not of the stuff of which successful criminals are made. I still had the feeling that he was keeping something back. As a test, I threatened to shoot him there and then, declaring that I cared very little what became of me now. In a frenzy of terror, he poured out a further story. It seems that Anita Grunberg did not quite trust the colonel. Whilst pretending to hand over him the stones she had taken from the hotel, she kept back some in her own possession. Carton advised her with his technical knowledge which to keep. If at any time these stones were produced, they were of such colour and quality as to be readily identifiable, and the experts at De Beers would admit at once that these stones had never passed through their hands. In this way, my story of a substitution would be supported, my name would be cleared, and suspicion would be diverted to the proper quarter. I gathered that, contrary to his usual practice, the colonel himself had been concerned in this affair. Therefore, Anita felt satisfied that she had a real hold over him, should she need it. Carden now proposed that I should make a bargain with Anita Grunberg, or Nadina, as she now called herself, for a sufficient sum of money. He thought that she would be willing to give up the diamonds and betray her former employer. He would cable to her immediately. I was still suspicious of Carton. He was a man whom it was easy enough to frighten, but who, in his fright, would tell so many lies that to sift the truth out from them would be no easy job. I went back to the hotel and waited. By the following evening, I judged that he would have received the reply to his cable. I called round to his house and was told that Mr. Carton was away, but would be returning on the morrow. Instantly, I became suspicious. In the nick of time, I found out that he was in reality sailing for England on the Kilmorden Castle, which left Cape Town in 2 days' time. I had just time to journey down and catch the same boat. I had no intention of alarming Carton by revealing my presence on board. I had done a good deal of acting in my time at Cambridge, and it was comparatively easy for me to transform myself into a grave, bearded gentleman of middle age. I avoided Carton carefully on board the boat, keeping to my own cabin as far as possible, under the pretense of illness. I had no difficulty in trailing him when we got to London. He went straight to an hotel, and did not go out until the following day. He left the hotel shortly before 1 o'clock. I was behind him. He went straight to a house agent in Knightsbridge. There he asked for particulars of houses to let on the river. I was at the next table also inquiring about houses. Then suddenly in walked Anita Grunberg. Nadina, whatever you like to call her. Superb, insolent, and almost as beautiful as ever. God, how I hated her. There she was, the woman who had ruined my life, and who had also ruined a better life than mine. At that minute, I could have put my hands round her neck and squeezed the light out of her inch by inch. Just for a minute or two, I saw red. I hardly took in what the agent was saying. It was her voice that I heard next, high and clear, with an exaggerated foreign accent. The Mill House Marlowe, the property of Sir Eustace Pedler. That sounds as though it might suit me. At any rate, I will go and see it. The man wrote her an order, and she walked out again in her regal, insolent manner. Not by word or a sign had she recognized Carton, yet I was sure that their meeting there was a preconceived plan. Then I started to jump to conclusions. Not knowing that Sir Eustace was at Cannes, I thought that this house-hunting business was a mere pretext for meeting him in the Mill House. I knew that he had been in South Africa at the time of the robbery, and never having seen him, I immediately leapt to the conclusion that he himself was the mysterious colonel of whom I had heard so much. I followed my two suspects along Knightsbridge. Nadina went into the Hyde Park Hotel. I quickened my pace and went in also. She walked straight into the restaurant, and I decided that I would not risk her recognizing me at the moment, but would continue to follow Carton. I was in great hopes that he was going to get the diamonds, and that by suddenly appearing and making myself known to him when he least expected it, I might startle the truth out of him. I followed him down into the tube station at Hyde Park Corner. He was standing by himself at the end of the platform. There was some girl standing near, but no one else. I decided that I would accost him then and there. You know what happened. In the sudden shock of seeing a man whom he imagined far away in South Africa, he lost his head and stepped back upon the line. He was always a coward. Under the pretext of being a doctor, I managed to search his pockets. There was a wallet with some notes in it and one or two unimportant letters. There was a roll of films, which I must have dropped somewhere later, and there was a piece of paper with an appointment made on it for the 22nd on the Kilmorden Castle. In my haste to get away before anyone detained me, I dropped that also. But fortunately, I remembered the figures. I hurried to the nearest cloakroom and hastily removed my makeup. I did not want to be laid by the heels for picking a dead man's pocket. Then I retraced my steps to the Hyde Park Hotel. Nadina was still having lunch. I needn't describe in detail how I followed her down to Marlow. She went into the house and I spoke to the woman at the lodge, pretending that I was with her. Then I too went in. He stopped. There was a tense silence. You will believe me, Anne, won't you? I swear before God that what I am going to say is true. I went into the house after her with something very like murder in my heart. And she was dead. I found her in that first floor room. God, it was horrible. Dead. And I was not more than 3 minutes behind her. And there was no sign of anyone else in the house. Of course, I realized at once the terrible position I was in. By one masterstroke, the blackmailed had rid himself of the blackmailer, and at the same time had provided a victim to whom the crime would be ascribed. The hand of the colonel was very plain. For the second time, I was to be his victim. Fool that I had been to walk into the trap so easily. I hardly know what I did next. I managed to go out of the place looking fairly normal, but I knew that it would not be long before the crime was discovered and a description of my appearance telegraphed all over the country. I lay low for some days, not daring to make a move. In the end, chance came to my aid. I overheard a conversation between two middle-aged gentlemen in the street, one of whom proved to be Sir Eustace Pedler. I at once conceived the idea of attaching myself to him as his secretary. The fragment of conversation I had overheard gave me my clue. I was now no longer so sure that Sir Eustace Pedler was the colonel. His house might have been appointed as a rendezvous by accident, or for some obscure motive that I had not fathomed. "Do you know," I interrupted, "that Guy Paget was in Marlow on the date of the murder?" "That settles it, then. I thought he was at Cannes with Sir Eustace."
"He was supposed to be in Florence, but he certainly never went there. I'm pretty certain he was really in Marlow, but of course I can't prove it."
"And to think I never suspected Paget for a minute until the night he tried to throw you overboard. The man's a marvellous actor."
"Yes, isn't he?"
"That explains why the Mill House was chosen. Paget could probably get in and out of it unobserved. Of course, he made no objection to my accompanying Sir Eustace across in the boat. He didn't want me laid by the heels immediately. You see, evidently, Nadina didn't bring the jewels with her to the rendezvous, as they had counted on her doing. I fancy that Carton really had them and concealed them somewhere on the Kilmorden Castle. That's where he came in. They hoped that I might have some clue as to where they were hidden. As long as the colonel did not recover the diamonds, he was still in danger, hence his anxiety to get them at all costs. Where the devil Carton hid them, if he did hide them, I don't know."
"That's another story," I quoted. "My story, and I'm going to tell it to you now." Chapter 27. Harry listened attentively whilst I recounted all the events that I have narrated in these pages. The thing that bewildered and astonished him most was to find that all along the diamonds had been in my possession, or rather in Suzanne's. That was a fact he had never suspected. Of course, after hearing his story, I realise the point of Cartansittle arrangement, or rather Nadine's, since I had no doubt that it was her brain which had conceived the plan. No surprise tactics executed against her or her husband could result in the seizure of the diamonds. The secret was locked in her own brain, and the Colonel was not likely to guess that they had been entrusted to the keeping of an ocean steward. Harry's vindication from the old charge of theft seemed assured. It was the other graver charge that paralysed all our activities, for as things stood, he could not come out in the open to prove his case. The one thing we came back to again and again was the identity of the Colonel. Was he or was he not Guy Paget?
I should say he was, but for one thing, said Harry. It seems pretty much of a certainty that it was Paget who murdered Anita Grunberg at Marlow, and that certainly lends colour to the supposition that he is actually the Colonel, since Anita's business was not of the nature to be discussed with a subordinate. No, the only thing that militates against that theory is the attempt to put you out of the way the night of your arrival here. You saw Paget left behind at Cape Town. By no possible means could he have arrived here before the following Wednesday. He's unlikely to have any emissaries in this part of the world, and all his plans were laid to deal with you in Cape Town. He might, of course, have cabled instructions to some lieutenant of his in Johannesburg, who could have joined the Rhodesian train at Mafeking. But his instructions would have had to be particularly definite to allow of that note being written.
We sat silent for a moment. Then Harry went on slowly.
You say that Mrs. Blair was asleep when you left the hotel and that you heard Sir Eustace dictating to Miss Pettigrew? Where was Colonel Race?
I could not find him anywhere.
Had he any reason to believe that you and I might be friendly with each other?
He might have had, I answered thoughtfully, remembering our conversation on the way back from Matapos. He's a very powerful personality, I continued, but not at all my idea of the Colonel. And anyway, such an idea would be absurd. He's in the Secret Service.
How do you know that he is? It's the easiest thing in the world to throw out a hint of that kind. No one contradicts it, and the rumour spreads until everyone believes it as gospel truth. It provides an excuse for all sorts of doubtful things. Anne, do you like Race?
I do. And I don't. He repels me and at the same time fascinates me. But I know one thing. I'm always a little afraid of him.
He was in South Africa, you know, at the time of the Kimberley robbery, said Harry slowly.
But it was he who told Suzanne all about the Colonel and how he had been in Paris trying to get on his track.
Camouflage, of a particularly clever kind.
But where does Paget come in? Is he in Race's pay?
Perhaps, said Harry slowly. He doesn't come in at all.
What?
Think back, Anne. Did you ever hear Paget's own account of that night on the Kilmorden?
Yes, through Sir Eustace.
I repeated it. Harry listened closely. He saw a man coming from the direction of Sir Eustace's cabin and followed him up on deck. Is that what he says? Now, who had the cabin opposite to Sir Eustace? Colonel Race. Supposing Colonel Race crept up on deck and foiled in his attack on you, fled round the deck and met Paget just coming through the saloon door. He knocks him down and springs inside, closing the door. We dash round and find Paget lying there. How's that?
You forgot that he declares positively it was you who knocked him down.
Well, suppose that just as he regains consciousness, he sees me disappearing in the distance. Wouldn't he take it for granted that I was his assailant, especially as he thought all along it was I he was following?
It's possible, yes, I said slowly, but it alters all our ideas, and there are other things.
Most of them are open to explanation. The man who followed you in Cape Town spoke to Paget, and Paget looked at his watch. The man might have merely asked him the time.
It was just a coincidence, you mean?
Not exactly. There's a method in all this, connecting Paget with the affair. Why was the Mill House chosen for the murder? Was it because Paget had been in Kimberley when the diamonds were stolen? Would he have been made the scapegoat if I had not appeared so providentially upon the scene?
Then you think he may be entirely innocent?
It looks like it, but If so, we've got to find out what he was doing in Marlowe. If he's got a reasonable explanation of that, we're on the right track. He got up. It's past midnight. Turn in, Anne, and get some sleep. Just before dawn, I'll take you over in the boat. You must catch the train at Livingston. I've got a friend there who will keep you hidden away until the train starts. You go to Bulawayo and catch the Byra train there. I can find out from my friend in Livingston what's going on at the hotel and where your friends are now.
Byra, I said meditatively.
Yes, Anne, it's Byra for you. This is man's work. Leave it to me.
We had had a momentary respite from emotion whilst we talked the situation out, but it was on us again now. We did not even look at each other. Very well, I said, and passed into the hut. I lay down on the skin-covered couch, but I didn't sleep, and outside I could hear Harry Rayburn pacing up and down, through the long, dark hours. At last he called me.
Come, Anne, it's time to go.
I got up and came out obediently. It was still quite dark, but I knew that dawn was not far off.
We'll take the canoe, not the motorboat, Harry began,
when suddenly he stopped dead and held up his hand.
Hush. What's that?
I listened, but could hear nothing. His ears were sharper than mine, however, the ears of a man who has lived long in the wilderness. Presently I heard it too, the faint splash of paddles in the water, coming from the direction of the right bank of the river and rapidly approaching our little landing stage. We strained our eyes in the darkness and could make out a dark blur on the surface of the water. It was a boat. Then there was a momentary spurt of flame. Someone had struck a match. By its light, I recognised one figure, the red-bearded Dutchman of the villa at Muizenberg. The others were natives.
Quick, back to the hut.
Harry swept me back with him. He took down a couple of rifles and a revolver from the wall.
Can you load a rifle?
I never have. Show me how. I grasped his instructions well enough. We closed the door and Harry stood by the window which overlooked the landing stage. The boat was just about to run alongside it.
Who's that?
Called out Harry in a ringing voice. Any doubt we might have had as to our visitor's intentions was swiftly resolved. A hail of bullets splattered round us. Fortunately, neither of us was hit. Harry raised the rifle. It spat murderously and again, I heard two groans and a splash.
That's given him something to think about, he muttered grimly,
as he reached for the second rifle.
Stand well back, Anne, for God's sake, and load quickly.
More bullets. One just grazed Harry's cheek. His answering fire was more deadly than theirs. I had the rifle reloaded when he turned for it. He caught me close with his left arm and kissed me once, savagely, before he turned to the window again. Suddenly he uttered a shout.
They're going. Had enough of it. They're a good mark out there on the water, and they can't see how many of us there are.
They're routed for the moment, but they'll be back. We'll have to get ready for them.
He flung down the rifle and turned to me.
Anne, you beauty, you wonder, you little queen, as brave as a lion, black-haired witch.
He caught me in his arms. He kissed my hair, my eyes, my mouth.
And now to business, he said, suddenly releasing me. Get out those tins of paraffin.
I did as I was told. He was busy inside the hut. Presently I saw him on the roof of the hut, crawling along with something in his arms. He rejoined me in a minute or two.
Go down to the boat. We'll have to carry it across the island to the other side.
He picked up the paraffin as I disappeared. They're coming back, I called softly. I had seen the blur moving out from the opposite shore. He ran down to me.
Just in time. Why, where the hell's the boat?
Both had been cut adrift. Harry whistled softly.
We're in a tight place, honey. Mind?
Not with you.
Ah, but dying together's not much fun. We'll do better than that. See, we've got two boatloads this time, going to land at two different points. Now for my little scenic effect.
Almost as he spoke, a long flame shot up from the hut. Its light illuminated two crouching figures huddled together on the roof.
My old clothes stuffed with rags, but they won't tumble to it for some time. Come, Anne, we've got to try desperate means.
Hand in hand, we raced across the island. Only a narrow channel of water divided it from the shore on that side.
We've got to swim for it.
Can you swim at all, Anne? Not that it matters. I can get you across. It's the wrong side for a boat, too many rocks, but the right side for swimming and the right side for Livingston.
I can swim a little further than that. What's the danger, Harry?
For I had seen the grim look on his face.
Sharks?
No, you little goose. Sharks live in the sea. But you're sharp, Anne. Crocs. That's the trouble.
Crocodiles?
Yes. Don't think of them. Or say your prayers, whichever you feel inclined.
We plunged in. My prayers must have been efficacious, for we reached the shore without adventure and drew ourselves up wet and dripping on the bank.
Now for Livingston. It's rough going, I'm afraid, and wet clothes won't make it any better, but it's got to be done.
That walk was a nightmare. My wet skirts flapping round my legs and my stockings were soon torn off by thorns. Finally, I stopped, utterly exhausted. Harry came back to me.
Hold up, honey. I'll carry you for a bit.
That was the way I came into Livingston, slung across his shoulder like a sack of coals. How he did it for all that way, I don't know. The first faint light of dawn was just breaking. Harry's friend was a young man of 20 years old who kept a store of native curios. His name was Ned. Perhaps he had another, but I never heard it. He didn't seem in the least surprised to see Harry walk in, dripping wet, holding an equally dripping female by the hand. Men are very wonderful. He gave us food to eat and hot coffee and got our clothes dried for us whilst we rolled ourselves in Manchester blankets of gaudy hue. In the tiny back room of the hut, we were safe from observation, whilst he departed to make judicious inquiries as to what had become of Sir Eustace's party and whether any of them were still at the hotel. It was then that I informed Harry that nothing would induce me to go to Byra. I never meant to, anyway, but now all reason for such proceedings had vanished. The point of the plan had been that my enemies believed me dead. Now that they knew I wasn't dead, my going to Byra would do no good whatever. They could easily follow me there and murder me quietly. I should have no one to protect me. It was finally arranged that I should join Suzanne, wherever she was, and devote all my energies to taking care of myself. On no account was I to seek adventures or endeavour to checkmate the Colonel. I was to remain quietly with her and await instructions from Harry. The diamonds were to be deposited in the bank at Kimberley under the name of Parker. There's one thing, I said thoughtfully. We ought to have a code of some kind. We don't want to be hoodwinked again by messages purporting to come from one to the other.
That's easy enough. Any message that comes genuinely from me will have the word "and" crossed out in it.
Without trademark, non-genuine, I murmured. What about wires?
Any wires from me will be signed Andy. Train will be in before long, Harry, said Ned, putting his head in and withdrawing it immediately.
I stood up. And shall I marry a nice, steady man if I find one? I asked demurely.
Harry came close to me.
My God, Anne, if you ever marry anyone else but me, I'll wring his neck. And as for you...
Yes, I said, pleasurably excited.
I shall carry you away and beat you black and blue.
What a delightful husband I have chosen, I said satirically. And doesn't he change his mind overnight?
Chapter 28. Extract from the diary of Sir Eustace Pedler.
As I remarked once before, I am essentially a man of peace. I yearn for a quiet life. And that's just the one thing I don't seem to be able to have. I am always in the middle of storms and alarms. The relief of getting away from Paget with his incessant nosing out of intrigues was enormous, and Miss Pettigrew is certainly a useful creature. Although there is nothing of the houri about her, one or two of her accomplishments are invaluable. It is true that I had a touch of liver at Bulawayo, and behaved like a bear in consequence, but I had had a disturbed night in the train. At 3 a.m., an exquisitely dressed young man, looking like a musical comedy hero of the Wild West, entered my compartment and asked where I was going. Disregarding my first murmur of tea, and for God's sake, don't put sugar in it, he repeated his question, laying stress on the fact that he was not a waiter, but an immigration officer. I finally succeeded in satisfying him that I was suffering from no infectious disease, that I was visiting Rhodesia from the purest of motives, and further gratified him with my full Christian names and my place of birth. I then endeavoured to snatch a little sleep. But some officious ass aroused me at 5:30 with a cup of liquid sugar, which he called tea. I don't think I threw it at him, but I know that that was what I wanted to do. He brought me unsugared tea, stone cold, at 6, and I then fell asleep utterly exhausted to awaken just outside Bulawayo and be landed with a beastly wooden giraffe, all legs and neck. But for these small contretemps, all had been going smoothly, and then fresh calamity befell. It was the night of our arrival at the falls. I was dictating to Miss Pettigrew in my sitting room when suddenly Mrs. Blair burst in without a word of excuse and wearing most compromising attire. "Where's Anne?" she cried. A nice question to ask, as though I were responsible for the girl. What did she expect Miss Pettigrew to think, that I was in the habit of producing Anne Bedingfeld from my pocket at midnight or thereabouts? Very compromising for a man in my position. "I presume," I said coldly, "that she is in her bed." I cleared my throat and glanced at Miss Pettigrew to show that I was ready to resume dictating. I hoped Mrs. Blair would take the hint. She did nothing of the kind. Instead, she sank into a chair and waved a slippered foot in an agitated manner.
"She's not in her room. I've been there. I had a dream, a terrible dream, that she was in some awful danger, and I got up and went to her room just to reassure myself, you know. She wasn't there, and her bed hadn't been slept in."
She looked at me appealingly.
"What shall I do, Sir Eustace?"
Repressing the desire to reply, "Go to bed and don't worry over nothing. An able-bodied young woman like Anne Bedingfeld is perfectly well able to take care of herself," I frowned judiciously. "What does race say about it?" Why should race have it all his own way? Let him have some of the disadvantages as well as the advantages of female society.
"I can't find him anywhere."
She was evidently making a night of it. I sighed and sat down in a chair. "I don't quite see the reason for your agitation," I said patiently.
"My dream?"
"That curry we had for dinner."
"Oh, Sir Eustace!"
The woman was quite indignant. "And yet everybody knows that nightmares are a direct result of injudicious eating. After all," I continued persuasively, "why shouldn't Anne Bedingfeld and Race go out for a little stroll without having the whole hotel aroused about it?"
"You think they've just gone out for a stroll together? But it's after midnight."
"One does these foolish things when one is young," I murmured, "though Race is certainly old enough to know better."
"Do you really think so?"
"I dare say they've run away to make a match of it," I continued soothingly, though fully aware that I was making an idiotic suggestion. "For after all, at a place like this, where is there to run away to?" I don't know how much longer I should have gone on making feeble remarks, but at that moment, Race himself walked in upon us. At any rate, I had been partly right. He had been out for a stroll, but he hadn't taken Anne with him. However, I had been quite wrong in my way of dealing with the situation. I was soon shown that. Race had the whole hotel turned upside down in 3 minutes. I've never seen a man more upset. The thing is very extraordinary. Where did the girl go? She walked out of the hotel, fully dressed, about 10 minutes past 11, and she was never seen again. The idea of suicide seems impossible. She was one of those energetic young women who are in love with life and have not the faintest intention of quitting it. There was no train either way until midday on the morrow, so she can't have left the place. Then where the devil is she? Race is almost beside himself, poor fellow. He has left no stone unturned. All the DCs, or whatever they call themselves, for hundreds of miles round, have been pressed into the service. The native trackers have run about on all fours. Everything that can be done is being done. But no sign of Anne Bedingfeld. The accepted theory is that she walked in her sleep.
There are signs on the path near the bridge which seem to show that the girl walked deliberately off the edge. If so, of course, she must have been dashed to pieces on the rocks below. Unfortunately, most of the footprints were obliterated by a party of tourists who chose to walk that way early on the Monday morning. I don't know that it's a very satisfactory theory. In my young days, I was always told that sleepwalkers couldn't hurt themselves, but their own sixth sense took care of them. I don't think the theory satisfies Mrs. Blair either. I can't make that woman out. Her whole attitude towards race has changed. She watches him now like a cat a mouse, and she makes obvious efforts to bring herself to be civil to him. And they used to be such friends, although she is unlike herself, nervous, hysterical, starting and jumping at the least sound. I'm beginning to think that it is high time I went to Joburg. A rumour came along yesterday of a mysterious island somewhere up the river with a man and a girl on it. Race got very excited. It turned out to be all a mare's nest, however. The man had been there for years and is well known to the manager of the hotel. He takes parties up and down the river in the season and points out crocodiles and a stray hippopotamus or so to them. I believe that he keeps a tame one which is trained to bite pieces out of the boat on occasions. Then he fends it off with a boat hook, and the party feel that they have really got to the back of beyond at last. How long the girl has been there is not definitely known, but it seems pretty clear that she can't be Anne, and there is a certain delicacy in interfering in other people's affairs. If I were this young fellow, I should certainly kick Race off the island if he came asking questions about my love affairs. Later. It is definitely settled that I go to Joburg tomorrow. Race urges me to do so. Things are getting unpleasant there, by all I hear, but I might as well go before they get worse. I dare say I shall be shot by a striker anyway. Mrs. Blair was to have accompanied me, but at the last minute she changed her mind and decided to stay on at the falls. It seems as though she couldn't bear to take her eyes off Race. She came to me tonight and said with some hesitation that she had a favour to ask. Would I take charge of her souvenirs for her? Not the animals, I asked in lively alarm. I always felt that I should get stuck with those beastly animals sooner or later. In the end, we effected a compromise. I took charge of two small wooden boxes for her which contained fragile articles. The animals are to be packed by the local store in vast crates and sent to Cape Town by rail, where Paget will see to their being stored. The people who are packing them say that they are of a particularly awkward shape, and that special cases will have to be made. I pointed out to Mrs. Blair that by the time she had got them home, those animals will have cost her easily £1 apiece. Paget is straining at the leash to rejoin me in Joburg. I shall make an excuse of Mrs. Blair's cases to keep him in Cape Town. I have written him that he must receive the cases and see to their safe disposal, as they contain rare curios of immense value. So, all is settled, and I and Miss Pettigrew will go off into the blue together. And anyone who has seen Miss Pettigrew will admit that it is perfectly respectable.
Chapter 29. Johannesburg, March the 6th.
There is something about the state of things here that is not at all healthy. To use the well-known phrase that I have so often read, we are all living on the edge of a volcano. Bands of strikers, or so-called strikers, patrol the streets and scowl at one in a murderous fashion. They are picking out the bloated capitalists ready for when the massacres begin, I suppose. You can't ride in a taxi. If you do, strikers pull you out again, and the hotels hint pleasantly that when the food gives out, they will fling you out on the mat. I met Reeves, my Labour friend of the Kilmorden, last night. He has cold feet worse than any man I ever saw. He's like all the rest of these people. They make inflammatory speeches of enormous length, solely for political purposes, and then wish they hadn't. He's busy now going about and saying he didn't really do it. When I met him, he was just off to Cape Town, where he meditates making a 3-day speech in Dutch.
vindicating himself, and pointing out that the things he said really meant something entirely different.
I am thankful that I do not have to sit in the Legislative Assembly of South Africa. The House of Commons is bad enough, but at least we have only one language and some slight restrictions as to length of speeches. When I went to the Assembly before leaving Cape Town, I listened to a grey-haired gentleman with a drooping moustache who looked exactly like the Mock Turtle in Alice in Wonderland. He dropped out his words one by one in a particularly melancholy fashion. Every now and then he galvanized himself to further efforts by ejaculating something that sounded like plat skeet, uttered fortissimo, and in marked contrast to the rest of his delivery. When he did this, half his audience yelled, "Woof, woof," which is possibly Dutch for "hear, hear," and the other half woke up with a start from the pleasant nap they'd been having. I was given to understand that the gentleman had been speaking for at least 3 days. They must have a lot of patience in South Africa. I have invented endless jobs to keep Paget in Cape Town, but at last the fertility of my imagination has given out, and he joins me tomorrow in the spirit of the faithful dog who comes to die by his master's side. And I was getting on so well with my reminiscences, too. I had invented some extraordinarily witty things that the strike leaders said to me, and I said to the strike leaders. This morning, I was interviewed by a government official. He was urbane, persuasive, and mysterious in turn. To begin with, he alluded to my exalted position and importance and suggested that I should remove myself, or be removed by him, to Pretoria.
"You expect trouble, then?" I asked.
His reply was so worded as to have no meaning whatsoever, so I gathered that they were expecting serious trouble. I suggested to him that his government were letting things go rather too far. "There is such a thing as giving a man enough rope and letting him hang himself, Sir Eustace."
"Oh, quite so, quite so.
It is not the strikers themselves who are causing the trouble. There is some organisation at work behind them. Arms and explosives have been pouring in, and we have made a haul of certain documents which throw a good deal of light on the methods adopted to import them. There is a regular code. Potatoes mean detonators, cauliflower rifles. Other vegetables stand for various explosives."
"That's very interesting," I commented.
"More than that, Sir Eustace, we have every reason to believe that the man who runs the whole show, the directing genius of the affair, is at this minute in Johannesburg."
He stared at me so hard that I began to fear that he suspected me of being the man. I broke out into a cold perspiration at the thought and began to regret that I had ever conceived the idea of inspecting a miniature revolution at first hand.
"Oh, no trains are running from Joburg to Pretoria," he continued, "but I can arrange to send you over by private car. In case you should be stopped on the way, I can provide you with 2 separate passes, one issued by the Union government and the other stating that you are an English visitor who has nothing whatsoever to do with the Union."
"One for your people and one for the strikers, eh?"
"Exactly."
The project did not appeal to me. I know what happens in a case of that kind. You get flustered and mix things up. I should hand the wrong pass to the wrong person, and it would end in my being summarily shot by a bloodthirsty rebel or one of the supporters of law and order, whom I notice guarding the streets wearing bowler hats and smoking pipes, with rifles tucked carelessly under their arms. Besides, what should I do with myself in Pretoria? Admire the architecture of the Union buildings and listen to the echoes of the shooting round Johannesburg? I should be penned up there God knows how long. They've blown up the railway line already, I hear. It isn't even as if one could get a drink there. They put the place under martial law 2 days ago. "My dear fellow," I said, "you don't seem to realise that I'm studying conditions on the Rand. How the devil am I going to study them from Pretoria? I appreciate your care for my safety, but don't worry about me. I shall be all right.
I warn you, Sir Eustace, that the food question is already serious."
"A little fasting will improve my figure," I said with a sigh.
we were interrupted by a telegram being handed to me. I read it with amazement.
Anne is safe, here with me at Kimberley. Suzanne Blair.
I don't think I ever really believed in the annihilation of Anne. There is something peculiarly indestructible about that young woman. She is like the patent balls that one gives to terriers. She has an extraordinary knack of turning up smiling. I still don't see why it was necessary for her to walk out of the hotel in the middle of the night in order to get to Kimberley. There was no train, anyway. She must have put on a pair of angel's wings and flown there, and I don't suppose she will ever explain. Nobody does, to me. I always have to guess. It becomes monotonous after a while. The exigencies of journalism are at the bottom of it, I suppose. How I shot the Rapids by our special correspondent. I refolded the telegram and got rid of my governmental friend. I don't like the prospect of being hungry, but I'm not alarmed for my personal safety. Smuts is perfectly capable of dealing with the revolution, but I would give a considerable sum of money for a drink. I wonder if Paget will have the sense to bring a bottle of whiskey with him when he arrives tomorrow. I put on my hat and went out, intending to buy a few souvenirs. The curio shops in Joburg are rather pleasant. I was just studying a window full of imposing carouses when a man coming out of the shop cannoned into me. To my surprise, it turned out to be Race. I can't flatter myself that he looked pleased to see me. As a matter of fact, he looked distinctly annoyed, but I insisted on his accompanying me back to the hotel. I get tired of having no one but Miss Pettigrew to talk to. "I had no idea you were in Joburg," I said chattily. "When did you arrive?" "Last night." "Where are you staying?" "With friends." He was disposed to be extraordinarily taciturn and seemed to be embarrassed by my questions. "I hope they keep poultry," I remarked. "A diet of new-laid eggs and the occasional slaughtering of an old cock will be decidedly agreeable soon, from all I hear." "By the way," I said, "when we were back in the hotel, have you heard that Miss Bedingfeld is alive and kicking?" He nodded. "She gave us quite a fright," I said airily. "Where the devil did she go to that night? That's what I'd like to know." "She was on the island all the time." "Which island? Not the one with the young man on it?"
"Yes."
"How very improper," I said. "Paget will be quite shocked. He always did disapprove of Anne Bedingfeld. I suppose that was the young man she originally intended to meet in Durban?"
"I don't think so."
"Don't tell me anything if you don't want to," I said, by way of encouraging him.
"I fancy that this is a young man we should all be very glad to lay our hands on."
"Not," I cried, in rising excitement. He nodded.
"Harry Raeburn, alias Harry Lucas. That's his real name, you know. He's given us all a sip once more, but we're bound to rope him in soon."
"Dear me, dear me," I murmured.
"We don't suspect the girl of complicity in any case."
"On her side, it's just a love affair."
"I always did think Race was in love with Anne. The way he said those last words made me feel sure of it."
"She's gone to Byra," he continued rather hastily. "Indeed," I said, staring. "How do you know?"
"She wrote to me from Bulawayo, telling me she was going home that way. The best thing she can do, poor child."
"Somehow I don't fancy she is in Byra," I said meditatively.
"She was just starting when she wrote." I was puzzled. Somebody was clearly lying. Without stopping to reflect that Anne might have excellent reasons for misleading statements, I gave myself up to the pleasure of scoring off Race. He's always so cocksure. I took the telegram from my pocket and handed it to him.
"Then how do you explain this?" I asked nonchalantly.
He seemed dumbfounded.
"She said she was just starting for Byra," he said in a dazed voice.
"I know that Race is supposed to be clever. He is, in my opinion, rather a stupid man. It never seemed to occur to him that girls do not always tell the truth."
"Kimberley, too.
What are they doing there?" he muttered.
"Yes, that surprised me. I should have thought Miss Anne would have been in the thick of it here, gathering copy for the Daily Budget."
"Kimberley," he said again. The place seemed to upset him. "There's nothing to see there. The pits aren't being worked." You know what women are, I said vaguely.
He shook his head and went off.
I have evidently given him something to think about. No sooner had he departed than my government official reappeared.
I hope you will forgive me for troubling you again, Sir Eustace, he apologised. But there are one or two questions I should like to ask you.
Certainly, my dear fellow, I said cheerfully. Ask away.
It concerns your secretary.
I know nothing about him, I said hastily. He foisted himself upon me in London, robbed me of valuable papers, for which I shall be hauled over the coals, and disappeared like a conjuring trick at Cape Town. It's true that I was at the Falls at the same time as he was, but I was at the hotel, and he was on an island. I can assure you that I never set eyes upon him the whole time that I was there. I paused for breath.
You misunderstand me. It was of your other secretary that I spoke.
What? Paget? I cried in lively astonishment. He's been with me 8 years, a most trustworthy fellow.
My interlocutor smiled. We are still at cross purposes. I refer to the lady.
Miss Pettigrew? I exclaimed.
Yes. She has been seen coming out of Agrosato's native curio shop.
God bless my soul, I interrupted. I was going into that place myself this afternoon. You might have caught me coming out.
There doesn't seem to be any innocent thing that one can do in Joburg without being suspected for it. Ah, but she has been seen there more than once, and in rather doubtful circumstances. I may as well tell you, in confidence, Sir Eustace, that the place is suspected of being a well-known rendezvous used by the secret organisation behind this revolution. That is why I should be glad to hear all that you can tell me about this lady. Where and how did you come to engage her?
She was lent to me, I replied coldly, by your own government. He collapsed utterly.
Chapter 30. Anne's narrative resumed.
1. As soon as I got to Kimberley, I wired to Suzanne. She joined me there with the utmost dispatch, heralding her arrival with telegrams sent off en route. I was awfully surprised to find that she really was fond of me. I thought I had been just a new sensation, but she positively fell on my neck and wept when we met. When we had recovered from our emotion a little, I sat down on the bed and told her the whole story from A to Z. "You always did suspect Colonel Race," she said thoughtfully, when I had finished. "I didn't until the night you disappeared. I liked him so much all along, and thought he would make such a nice husband for you. Oh, Anne, dear, don't be cross. But how do you know that this young man of yours is telling the truth? You believe every word he says." "Of course I do," I cried indignantly. "But what is there in him that attracts you so?"
"I don't see that there's anything in him at all, except his rather reckless good looks
and his modern shake-come-stone-age love-making." I poured out the vials of my wrath upon Suzanne for some minutes.
"Just because you're comfortably married and getting fat, you've forgotten that there's any such thing as romance," I ended.
"Oh, I'm not getting fat, Anne. All the worry I've had about you lately must have worn me to a shred."
"You look particularly well nourished," I said coldly. "I should say you must have put on about half a stone."
"And I don't know that I'm so comfortably married either," continued Suzanne in a melancholy voice. "I've been having the most dreadful cables from Clarence, ordering me to come home at once. At last I didn't answer them, and now I haven't heard for over a fortnight." I'm afraid I didn't take Suzanne's matrimonial troubles very seriously. She'll be able to get round Clarence all right when the time comes. I turned the conversation to the subject of the diamonds. Suzanne looked at me with a dropped jaw.
"I must explain, Anne. You see, as soon as I began to suspect Colonel Race, I was terribly upset about the diamonds. I wanted to stay on at the Falls in case he might have kidnapped you somewhere close by, but didn't know what to do about the diamonds. I was afraid to keep them in my possession."
Suzanne looked round her uneasily, as though she feared the walls might have ears, and then whispered vehemently in my ear.
"A distinctly good idea," I approved. "At the time, that is. It's a bit awkward now. What did Sir Eustace do with the cases? The big ones were sent to Cape Town. I heard from Paget before I left the Falls, and he enclosed the receipt for their storage. He's leaving Cape Town today, by the by, to join Sir Eustace in Johannesburg. I see, I said thoughtfully. And the small ones, where are they? I suppose Sir Eustace has got them with him. I turned the matter over in my mind. Well, I said at last, it's awkward, but it's safe enough. We'd better do nothing for the present. Suzanne looked at me with a little smile. You don't like doing nothing, do you, Anne? Not very much, I replied honestly. The one thing I could do was to get hold of a timetable and see what time Guy Paget's train would pass through Kimberley. I found that it would arrive at 5:40 on the following afternoon and depart again at 6. I wanted to see Paget as soon as possible, and that seemed to me a good opportunity. The situation on the Rand was getting very serious, and it might be a good time before I got another chance. The only thing that livened up the day was a wire dispatch from Johannesburg, a most innocent-sounding telegram. Arrived safely, all going well. Eric here, also Eustace, but not Guy. Remain where you are for the present. Andy. 2. Eric was our pseudonym for Race. I chose it because it is a name I dislike exceedingly. There was clearly nothing to be done until I could see Paget. Suzanne employed herself in sending off a long, soothing cable to the far-off Clarence. She became quite sentimental over him, in her way, which of course is quite different from me and Harry. She is really fond of Clarence. "I do wish he was here, Anne," she gulped. "It's such a long time since I've seen him." "Have some face cream," I said soothingly. Suzanne rubbed a little on the tip of her charming nose. "I shall want some more face cream soon, too," she remarked. "And you can only get this kind in Paris." She sighed. "Paris." "Suzanne," I said, "very soon you'll have had enough of South African adventure." "I should like a really nice hat," admitted Suzanne wistfully. "Shall I come with you to meet Guy Paget tomorrow?" "I prefer to go alone. He'd be shyer speaking before two of us." So it came about that I was standing in the doorway of the hotel on the following afternoon, struggling with a recalcitrant parasol that refused to go up, while Suzanne lay peacefully on her bed with a book and a basket of fruit. According to the hotel porter, the train was on its good behaviour today and would be almost on time, though he was extremely doubtful whether it would ever get through to Johannesburg. The line had been blown up, so he solemnly assured me. It sounded cheerful. The train drew in just 10 minutes late. Everybody tumbled out on the platform and began walking up and down feverishly. I had no difficulty in espying Paget. I accosted him eagerly. He gave his usual nervous start at seeing me, somewhat accentuated this time. "Dear me, Miss Bedingfeld, I understood that you had disappeared." "I have reappeared again," I told him solemnly. "And how are you, Mr. Paget?" "Very well, thank you. Looking forward to taking up my work again with Sir Eustace." "Mr. Paget," I said, "there is something I want to ask you. I hope that you won't be offended, but a lot hangs on it, more than you can possibly guess. I want to know what you were doing at Marlow on the 8th of January last." He started violently. "Really, Miss Bedingfeld, indeed, you were there, weren't you?" For reasons of my own, I was in the neighbourhood, yes." "Won't you tell me what those reasons were? Sir Eustace has not already told you?" "Sir Eustace? Does he know?" "I am almost sure that he does." "I hoped he had not recognised me, but from the hints he has let drop and his remarks, I fear it is only too certain. In any case, I meant to make a keen breast of the matter and offer my resignation. He's a peculiar man, Miss Bedingfeld, with an abnormal sense of humour. Ah, it seems to amuse him to keep me on tenterhooks. All the time, I dare say, he was perfectly well aware of the true facts. Possibly he has known them for years." I hoped that sooner or later I should be able to understand what Paget was talking about. He went on fluently. "It is difficult for a man of Sir Eustace's standing to put himself in my position. I know that I was in the wrong, but it seems a harmless deception. I would have thought it better taste on his part to have tackled me outright, instead of indulging in covert jokes at my expense. A whistle blew, and the people began to surge back into the train. "Yes, Mr. Paget," I broke in, "I'm sure I quite agree with all you're saying about Sir Eustace, but why did you go to Marlowe?"
"It was wrong of me, but natural under the circumstances. Yes, I still feel natural under the circumstances."
"What circumstances?" I cried desperately. For the first time, Paget seemed to recognise that I was asking him a question. His mind detached itself from the peculiarities of Sir Eustace and his own justification, and came to rest on me.
"I beg your pardon, Miss Bedingfeld," he said stiffly, "but I fail to see your concern in the matter."
He was back in the train now, leaning down to speak to me. I felt desperate. What could one do with a man like that?
"Of course, if it's so dreadful that you're ashamed to speak of it to me," I began spitefully.
At last I had found the right stop. Paget stiffened and flushed.
"Dreadful? Ashamed? I don't understand you."
"Then tell me." In 3 short sentences he told me. At last I knew Paget's secret. It was not in the least what I expected. I walked slowly back to the hotel. There a wire was handed to me. I tore it open. It contained full and definite instructions for me to proceed forthwith to Johannesburg, or rather to a station this side of Johannesburg, where I should be met by a car. It was signed, not Andy, but Harry. I sat down in a chair to do some very serious thinking. Chapter 31. From the Diary of Sir Eustace Pedler.
Johannesburg, March 7. Paget has arrived.